You're tuned in to the HR Bandit podcast, your one-way ticket to the latest and craziest in the world of work. In partnership with Timber Media, Podcaster for India Inc. is sponsored by Adrenaline eSystems Limited.
Hey, hey! Welcome to HR Bandit. This is your host, Ankita, and you're tuned into the pod where we discuss the latest and greatest in the world of work. I am going to start by acknowledging the mood of the moment. There is an air of anxiety about the future. The tech industry has been hit hard the past few weeks, and so have a lot of others. And both Zuckerberg and Elon Musk's emails to employees had one word that stood out. They had many words in common, but the one word of the season is macroeconomics, a subject that's no longer happy to be ignored or shoved into the corner. If there was ever a time to pay attention to what the macroeconomic factors are telling us about the future of work, it is now. And where better to start than by tuning in to this pod? Bandits, I'm so excited to have you here for what can only be referred to our best one yet. Think of it as an episode, as an introductory listening, Macroeconomics 101 if you must. We are going to play this a little differently than we usually do. Our guest on the show today and I will both pick two macroeconomic factors that we believe are having a big impact now and will continue to do so in the year ahead. So without further ado, let me introduce you to Neil Morrison. Neil is the Director of Human Resources with Severn Trent, an England-based water company that's a constituent of the FTSE 100 Index. Neil has the responsibility for HR as well as internal and external communication teams. Neil started a career in HR management in 1996, has worked across a range of different sectors and FTSE 100 companies, including Rentokil Initial and GUS, which later became Home Retail Group. Before joining Severn Trent, Neil led the merger that created Penguin Random House, the world's largest trade publisher. Neil, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Thank you. Yes, I'm really well, thank you. It is obviously the end of the week, which is always a good thing in the world of work. And for a water company, it's raining here in the UK, which is absolutely brilliant as well. So everything couldn't be better. And it's lovely to be here and lovely to chat to you.
Amazing. So we definitely aren't running out of water anytime soon.
Well, do you know, it's been a really tricky summer, actually, in the UK. So we had a very, very dry period of time. So there's been lots of problems for people, particularly in the south of the UK. So everybody's quite pleased to see the rain coming down and returning to normal British weather of grey skies and rain. That's a lovely thing to see.
Oh, I never thought I'd hear someone say that, but it is true. So Neil, I know we have a whole bunch of very interesting and somewhat serious topics in store for us today. So before we jump into it, what is one piece of news that made you smile this week?
Yeah, so I was going to say Twitter, because I think the whole situation there is just literally comedy in action. But actually, the story that's really made me smile is about a two-year-old called Harper in the northeast of England. And Harper is in the process of being potty trained. And anyone with young children will know the process of potty training is not always the easiest thing. I went through it 20 odd years ago with my two. But unfortunately, in the process of potty training, Harper managed to get the toilet seat around her head to the point that the fire brigade needed to be called to come and cut the toilet seat off poor Harper, who is very healthy and well, wasn't hurt at all. I think just a little bit of pride damaged. So yeah, a lovely, lovely story in a feast of gloom and doom.
I love that. Okay. Well, and people listening can't hear or see us, but yeah, that had me smiling ear to ear. But the thing that I read today, and obviously wasn't as amusing as Twitter or having a toilet cut open, I came across this article, and of course, Bandits, everything we talk about today will be referred to in the show notes. So all links are there. I was reading this news article which said, Ukraine is now holding, there's a volunteer group that is organizing what they're calling repair raves. So they're essentially DJs playing music, people dancing while cleaning up rubble, restoring homes and so on. And they said it's bringing a lot of youngsters in who may have either become numb to the news and so on. So I loved, it was just such a nice thought of saying music's still bringing people together in all different ways. Yeah, that made me smile.
It's, I don't know whether you know the book Fish, which is based out of Pike Street Market in Philadelphia, and they talk about work made fun gets done is basically broadly the principle around the book. And I think there's a lot to that. If you can smile whilst you're, even the hardest task actually becomes a little bit easier, doesn't it?
Of course. And it's easier to smile when you're all together. Like, virtual has definitely made it harder to make work fun. But we're not going to get into that. That's not our topic for the day. I'm going to jump straight in. So, rarely has recession been forecast so far in advance. On this very pod, we first talked about recession this year in June in an episode with Dave Ulrich. Now, at that time, already people were predicting a downturn, the things that needed to be done to help us stop us from rushing into recession. Fast forward to now, one could say that several economies are on the verge of collapse. It may or may not be true, but the Eurozone, the UK, the countries where housing bubble have inflated significantly, like Canada and Australia, they're all struggling. And things are also changing very swiftly. Now, back in June, we were talking about the Great Resignation and what organizations should be doing to help retain its talent, which is very contrary to what we're seeing now. Neil, I know it's a difficult choice because there's so much happening in the world, but give us your first pick.
Yeah, so I think the thing that's really on my mind is around inflation and the cost of living. I think, you know, it's slightly different in different countries, obviously, but I think generally what we're seeing is pressure coming on in terms of cost of living, whether that's through fuel costs, whether that's through energy costs. And the reason I think it's really interesting for us in HR profession is that there's two kind of impacts on the workplace. The first is directly. So lots of our organizations are going to be experiencing that in terms of, you know, their overheads and their expenditure and the impact that has in terms of, you know, what you do around prices, because obviously if you increase your price, then you're fueling that inflationary pressure. Do you do it by cutting costs? And you mentioned earlier, you know, we're seeing in many organizations announcements around kind of reduction in headcount, which is obviously one of the, I suppose, go-to places that organizations go when they want to reduce headcount. But the other way that this is really interesting is that it's the pressure on individual employees. And so, you know, in their personal lives, they're going to be making decisions about, you know, I was talking about the weather here in the UK, but am I putting the heating on or am I not putting the heating on? You know, am I going to drive or actually am I going to, you know, try and walk or take public transport to try and reduce my costs there? What's going to happen to my mortgage if I've got one in terms of my house and or my rent? And so it's this kind of duality that it's both something we've got to face into in our organizations, in our offices, in warehouses, in our contact centers and how we support our business. But also it's the individual experience that employees are going through and how that feels for them. And I think it's something we've got to be very, very mindful of, particularly given everything that people have been through over the last few years.
I agree. It's like the madness never ends. And I think a true indication of a trend is when TikTok videos start pouring in on that topic. And all I've been seeing recently is, how do you save energy? Now you turn off the tap. It's like everyone's thinking about, okay, how do I make my bills a little smaller? And I've been poring over a few macroeconomic outlook reports, especially McKinsey and EY's for September and October. And the number of times inflation has been repeated, I didn't count, but I can guarantee it's 10 and more. And there was also a EY CEO Outlook Pulse released in October 2022, where almost all CEOs, 69%, predicted it will negatively impact their company's performance. And of that 16% identified it as the single biggest threat to their company's revenue and margins. Now, the same report also has a bunch of interesting mitigation recommendations. But while our listeners can go through that report and read the recommendations that are in there, Neil, what do you think are the mitigation steps that are going to be most popular and probably the most helpful over the next 12 months?
Yes, so I fear that some of the mitigation actually probably isn't going to be greatly helpful, if I'm totally honest, because I think, you know, having been in the corporate world for 30 years, what you tend to see is some of the same behaviors in terms of reducing investment, you know, headcount reductions, things like this. But the thing that I thought was really interesting in the report, and as you mentioned earlier, I look after marketing and communications as well. And so one of the things I thought was really interesting was around narrative to shareholders, narrative to investors, narrative to employees. And I think it's something that we should focus on, in that if we start talking down what's going on, if we start being very negative in our language or very if we start suggesting that perhaps we're not in control of things and it's all this external world that's going on and we can't do anything about it and we're the poor victims, I think that, one, that makes investors worry about management teams and whether they're in control of kind of what is going on. Two, it makes employees start to think, oh, you know, we're in the middle of the sea in a tiny boat and we don't know what's going on. So I think the kind of strength of narrative, of reframing things, of talking about, you know, this is a short period of time and actually we need to plan for the longer term. We need to continue to invest in the right things, in skills, in infrastructure. And, you know, we will weather it by making prudent decisions. I think that's one of the things that I think as leaders of organizations, we should really be taking away, because we can talk ourselves into a longer recession if we want, or we can talk ourselves into a shorter recession. And we've got some choices about that. And it's not entirely out of our hands.
I love that. I think this, I'm very tempted to move into my thing. But before I do, there's something that you said that really resonated. I was, so obviously in prep for the pod, I've been having this conversation with a few people. And I came across so many people who, obviously, like, I also didn't know the ins and outs of it till, you know, start reading and digging in. But a lot of people have a different impression of what leads to a recession and what could lead to our economy bouncing back to being healthy. And that lack of understanding dictates a lot of actions for both business and individuals. And it was very surprising because I was speaking to yesterday and they were like, oh, it's all, a lot of the recession and inflation is narrative, and we can easily talk ourselves out of it. And I was there arguing, no, but, you know, Federal Reserves, you can't keep pumping money into the economy, like purchasing, or the money that's circulating has to, like, either reduce or go up based on what's required and so on. But it is right. And I was, maybe we can also weave into the narrative just why it's happening, because it's just like unknown of what's happening. Like, okay, there is a high inflation, there is an impending recession, but then how, what will actually end it? Why is it happening? And that understanding is probably, everyone's just like, oh, it's energy crisis. It's a different thing in each country that's leading to it.
I think that's right. And I think what I would say is, I think there are macroeconomic factors that will cause it, that are going to take place. But how deep and how long it is depends partly on confidence. And confidence comes back to the narrative, which is, if you talk yourself into a dark place, then maybe you don't start investing quick enough, or you don't start hiring quick enough because you're expecting it, and that then becomes self-perpetuating. So that there are definitely things out of control, but there are also things within control. And I think it's recognizing that, I think, is the sweet spot.
I absolutely agree. And I wouldn't have thought of it had you not mentioned it. Okay, so I'm going to share my first pick, and I'm saving my best for the last. But my pick right now is climate change and sustainability. And I picked this before I read the EY report. I was not influenced. And truth be told, like you mentioned earlier, there's no getting around it. Energy and fuel prices are rising. It is a big business risk. But while a lot of people have poised it as a reason to halt sustainability actions, it's also been poised as a reason by equal number of people to say it's a reason to accelerate, to try and reduce this whole dependency that we have on oil and gas. Now, in the last year alone, like for people who might think climate change is still a fiction and years away, we have seen a rise in weather-related disasters. There has been a proportional increase in home insurance premiums, like with everything increasing. That's another added cost, but it's also leading to a drop in GDP, which is quoted as about 4.5%. We had COP27 and the whole conversation of carbon credits came back up again. So decarbonization, carbon credits was a big theme. Essentially, it's the richer countries who have higher emission rates pay the developing countries to help them invest in green fuel. And it's whole like Coke now, for example, has these many carbon credits that it has to pass out to another competitor or country. So clearly decarbonization and sustainability are macroeconomic factors that can no longer be ignored. Neil, could you help us connect the dots between how this is a macroeconomic factor, probably a mitigation also for everything that's going on, to the impact on how we work? I know some organizations are already reviewing their energy consumptions, asking, some have even gone ahead and asked employees to work from home so that the organizations don't have to invest as much in infrastructure. How big of an impact do you think this is going to have on how we work?
I think it's going to, in the longer term, be seismic in terms of the impact in terms of work. I think what we'll probably see in the short term is a bit of a loss of focus on this because, you know, as economic pressures come in, people start to, you know, deprioritize, for example, reducing emissions. But I guess, you know, the sorts of things we're starting to see are things like carbon tax, internal carbon taxes within organizations. I was talking to an organization the other day that was basically what they do is they give an allowance that people have in terms of travel. And it, as a budget holder, you kind of get an allowance, not a cash allowance, but a carbon allowance. And then once you're over that, you start to get into a start to be taxed. Another organization I was talking about, were basically doing this in terms of flights. So international business, where they were giving a certain number of flights a year and saying, that's it. If you're over that, you then start to have your budget reduced. So there's different ways that organizations are trying to build it in. I think, you know, it depends on the sector. So for us, we do a lot of engineering and construction. And so carbon reduction is really quite complex. And I think that's the other interesting thing about this is the answer, I don't think, is going to come from the top in the way that we often expect in organizations. I think a lot of the answer to carbon reduction within businesses is going to come bottom up because the people who understand it, who get it, who probably are most passionate about it, are often some of the younger employees within organizations who can find different ways of doing things and different ways of looking at how we work. The answer isn't going to be to tell everyone to work from home because ultimately, you know, that's just going to get caught in terms of, you know, I don't know, scope 3 emissions or whatever it would be, you know. So at some point in time, that's just going to get captured. But it is an opportunity, I think, to really engage workforces in terms of innovation and creativity and looking at your kind of impact. But it's definitely starting to happen.
Yeah, it could probably be a KPI for each individual. Like, how have you helped the organization be more sustainable? And that's a goal you're measured against. It's not optional anymore. I love it. Especially because we've traded in silver, we've traded in gold, in crypto. Now we're going to be trading in carbon credits or flight miles and how much emissions you resented. Neil, go on, give us your second pick.
Yes, yeah, so my second piece is around skills and essential skill shortages. And you know, since the pandemic, I want to say ended, but I don't know. Do pandemics ever end? They become endemic, then I suppose is the point. But, you know, we've seen some really funny things going on in labour markets around the world with, you know, skills not being met by, or jobs and labour not being met, available for the required kind of vacancies. And it feels to me there's a bit of a challenge for business about longer term investment in skills and development and growth. And if we don't do that, we're basically going to hamper our economies because they're not going to be able to grow and be as productive as they can be. And I don't think we can continue to look to government to try and find the answers, because the kind of skills that we need are changing so quickly that only business, I think, really can play the role in developing it. And so it's a real kind of challenge, and it's something that I think in the HR community we need to get better at connecting the dots between investment in training skills and people and economic productivity, profit, growth in our organizations, because the two things are absolutely interlinked. But I think sometimes we don't necessarily join the dots. And I think there's a real opportunity for HR people, you know, around the globe to go, I can drive growth in our organization. I can drive productivity. I can drive profitability. But in order to do that, we need to be investing in these skills, these resources.
I know, and I think we need to go earlier and earlier into the pipeline. Like, we first said, okay, we're going to train current hires. Then we moved to a phase where we're going to say we're going to train our future hires. And that extended to, like, just people who are, like, 1 to 5 years from getting into your organization potentially. And I think now we need to go much earlier into the pipeline. And a lot of organizations don't see the benefit of doing that, because you probably see the impact of it 15 years down the line, and right now businesses are like, we don't even know whether we'll exist 15 years later. So do we make that investment now?
I think that's right. We talk about speed to competence a lot in my organization, which is, you know, if it's going to take 3 years for someone to get competent, then if I need a competent person, I need to start training 3 years before then. And I think it's just a different way of framing investment in skills.
Absolutely agree. And I also was reading that the retirement, like the amount of workforce that is now going to go and retire, is so high, and like it's unbalanced. The people we have out of our workforce is going to be much higher than the people we have coming in. So you're right. It is a factor that we really need to be keeping our eyes on.
You're tuned in to the HR Bandit podcast, your one-way ticket to the latest and craziest in the world of work. In partnership with Timber Media, Podcaster for India Inc. is sponsored by Adrenaline eSystems Limited.
And then I'm going to move in to my favorite and last pick of the day. So drum rolls. But it is exchange rate volatility. And it is directly tied to inflation, but I think it is a macroeconomic condition of its own. Like, I was flabbergasted when I first came across the impact it could potentially have. It has a far-reaching impact on cash flows, operating profits. I'm going to try and explain this via an example or two, because I've been trying doing this with my friends for a while, and some get it, some don't, but let's hope I've gotten better at my explanation skills. So let's think, for example, an organization that trades in multiple markets. So let's say US-based buys products from England, who issues invoices in British pounds. And if the British pound goes up in value, then it costs more for the business to pay the invoice. And if the British pound falls, it costs less. So this fluctuation clearly impacts account receivables, account payables, and debt. So cash flow. Now, volatility also, if I was to define the three major risks, I would say there's transaction risk, there's economic risk, and there's translation risk. So transaction risk is something I explained. So depending on it, if your cash flows vary. But what was very interesting for me is economic risk, because it impacts whether you would invest globally or would you invest more in the local market. And translation risk is also tied in closely. For example, you have a mother organization that's based in the US and has branches all over the world, but they still have to report financials in dollars. So when they get the money from the branches into the mother company, depending on the exchange rate, that number will vary, even if nothing else has changed for that business. And it is scary to think that something like this would have such a big impact on business. And when I was saying that, how do businesses deal with this? There are a lot of hedging options, much like we do our financial investments. And one of it is like, okay, one possible way is optimization via global reach. So you expand through multiple organizations, and it potentially hedges against the currency rates, right? And that was my key takeaway. And I was like, okay, maybe organizations are all going to go more global. But then there's also organizations who've now started thinking, okay, that risk is too high. I'm going to work domestically only, where there is no impact of exchange of currency rate, but that impacts competitiveness. So Neil, I know I've gone back and forth. I don't know whether I've done a better job of explaining it this time over than I've done in the past. But what do you think is going to happen if the currency or the exchange rate continues to be as volatile?
It's really tricky, isn't it, for companies, this? And I think one of the points is around, you know, so there's two parts. There's kind of supply chain side, and then there's kind of price sensitivity. I think the supply chain side, I think one of the challenges is around diversification of supply chain globally. So that, you know, you're not tied into particularly one kind of country, and therefore, you know, as we've seen with the invasion of Ukraine, the challenges that you then get when you're tied in, whether it's chemicals or fuel or what have you. And I think organizations can do a lot to mitigate the risk by diversification of their supply chain. I think in terms of selling to markets, it's hard, right? I think, you know, if you're manufacturing in one country and then you're passing the price on into another country where inflation or exchange rates are doing something entirely different, that's quite tricky. And I'm not sure there's a brilliant answer for that, other than perhaps, as you say, diversification in terms of your region, so that you're making a better margin in one country, which is offsetting maybe a lower margin in another. The other point I'd probably make on this is, you know, there's a big role for government. And the reason that the euro was introduced, which obviously the UK isn't part of, but was to have the exchange rate mechanism to try and reduce the volatility between countries so that you didn't get that. And I think, you know, government intervention to prevent volatility in exchange rates is probably quite important. The British government has done a very good job of that over the last few months. But I think, you know, businesses can do so much, but ultimately there's probably a role for government to play as well.
Absolutely. And it's like, this is another place which is, well, I wouldn't call it unprecedented, but for the past two decades, the dollar has always been weaker than the euro, right? July was the first time that the two currencies were at par, and then it tipped over now, right? And the dollar continues to strengthen, and so many of the global transactions take place in dollar, right? And it's impacted the developing economies, because I was reading about Argentina, Turkey, Sri Lanka, because they've all paid their creditors in dollars, because that's like the most popular currency. And if it's gone stronger, they're suddenly feeling much more pressure. And it's Yeah, it's mind-blowing on how something that I never personally paid that much attention to is dictating so many large business decisions.
And of course, it's all fabricated. I mean, exchange rates are all, it's creation, isn't it? It isn't actually a thing. So we're creating something that causes, all of these kind of challenges.
You know, I love the concept of a euro. Like, imagine if you had only one currency in the world. Like, how bad would that be?
Bitcoin. There you go.
Yeah, no, given how all my investments in crypto have crashed, I'm just like, please, like, it inflicts pain every time I hear any conversation on crypto. But with that, there you have it, folks. Our top four picks: inflation, climate change, skill shortage, and exchange rate volatility. Neil, it is time to wrap this up. I have to get us out of here. Any closing comments?
I just say one thing. Isn't it lovely to be talking about macroeconomics on an HR podcast, isn't it? It's exactly the kind of thing that HR people should be talking about more. So it's lovely to be able to do that. And let's hope that lots of people go away and start talking about these things in their organizations.
Absolutely. Because I was thinking, like, before the past 2 years, we used to focus on like same kind of things because the environment was more or less predictable. And then it shakes things up, and then you can no longer be like sitting in a well and not looking at the world outside. And then when you start unpicking it, you're just like, Jesus, I should have taken my econ course a little more seriously in school or college. But Neil, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you here and host the Macroeconomics 101 class with me. It is without doubt our best one yet. And with that, I'm going to get us out of here. On behalf of NHRDN, Neil and I, we are out. Perfect. That's the end of the show. What did you think?
Fabulous. Yeah, that was a great conversation. And genuinely, it's lovely to be talking about these things, isn't it? You know, it's not talking about maybe some of this HR stuff that people often talk about. So, yeah, really, really good topics.
Thank you. I'm going to send you to usually get the recording at a day or two.
You're tuned in to the HR Bandit podcast, your one-way ticket to the latest and craziest in the world of work. In partnership with Timber Media, Podcaster for India Inc. is sponsored by Adrenaline eSystems Limited.